Through the phone, she heard her agent speak in a challenging voice. I thought you told me she was at a safe house somewhere.
She was. She escaped a couple days ago.
Violator said, I talked to her before you brought her over to the States. She wanted to go. She wanted to work for you. What the hell were you doing to her that caused her to escape?
We weren't doing anything. She was on her way to becoming an asset. She was doing great, only weeks from operational status.
Until one day she just walked out the front door.
Yes. Well, not exactly. The safe house was hit by armed hostiles. Her motives remain unclear because from the surveillance cameras we see that she was in the process of escaping even before the raid began. There is no way she knew she was in any danger when she made the decision to run, unless she'd been tipped off somehow that gunmen were coming. We don't think they were there to rescue her because of her actions against them.
You were saying she killed one, aren't you?
Two, in fact.
Court then asked, who were the attackers?
Mexican sicarios, although we assume they were working for someone who ordered them to eliminate Zoya. But we don't know who, and we don't know how they knew Zoya was there.
She heard the sigh through the encrypted phone line. Let me help you with that. You have a big fucking leak at CIA.
Brewer sighed. Thank you, Violator, but we are well aware of that much, at least.
And people like Zoya and I are exposed and vulnerable. What the hell are you guys doing about it?
We're working on it. We have it narrowed down to a few possibles.
Violator said, so, again, what do I do about Zoya now?
To herself, the woman at the desk in McLean, Virginia said,
shoot that bitch, shoot yourself, and then I'll run over Hightower with a bus.
But to Violator, she said,
do nothing, let this play out. Then follow Anthem when she leaves.
What the hell is Anthem?
Her code name.
Right.
A few seconds later, he spoke again.
Well, shit.
What?
She's not going anywhere. The office lights just turned on, and a bunch of dudes with guns are in there looking for her.
To this, Brewer just repeated herself.
Let it play, Violator.
On her knees, behind the desk, Zoya drew the Walther pistol she had taken from Gorik Sholga earlier in the day, and she hefted it for use. She was about to rise to her knees and fire when a voice in Russian called out to her.
Zoya Fyodorovna Zakharova, we mean you no harm. We only wish to speak.
She did not recognize the voice at all. It was definitely not Vladi Belyakov or Gorik Sholga, the only two native Russians, as far as she was aware, who knew she was here in London.
What the hell is going on?
I have several armed men with me. If you exchange fire with us, we will have no choice but to defend ourselves. But we would rather do this peacefully.
Zoya looked at the glass window, 15 feet to her left. She could run for it, shoot a hole in it, then dive out. But then she'd fall several floors to her death. Not an option. Engaging multiple armed men didn't seem like good odds either, especially because they clearly had her pinpointed to behind the desk, as the office held no other obvious hiding places. She did the only thing she could think to do.
Хорошо.
Fine, she said, and continued speaking Russian.
I'm sliding my pistol over the desk, and I'm standing up slowly with hands raised. Does that work for you?
As long as you play no tricks, that works fine, said the Russian voice.
She heard him speaking English softly, conferring with others, which surprised her. These obviously weren't SVR personnel. So who were they? She put the Walther on the mahogany desk above her, then slid it forward, all the way over to the side. It bounced along the wooden floor. The Russian man himself now said,
Хорошо.
Zoya stood straight, all in black, her dark hair sweat-soaked and matted from the balaclava she'd dropped on the floor behind the desk. Her gloved hands were away from her body, and she looked across the bright room at five men. Three had dark hair, rifles pointed at her chest, and combat gear. One was an impressively tall and broad, blonde-haired figure in a leather jacket who seemed to be unarmed, and the fifth was a younger man wearing a dark goatee and a nice suit. He had a small pistol in his left hand, down by his side. This man spoke to her in Russian, the same voice she'd heard before.
Step out, please.
She had knives on her, but she wouldn't go for them, and she had a revolver in an ankle holster, but she wouldn't make a move for that either. No, they had her. She'd comply and see where this went.
Who are you? She asked the Russian. And who are they?
My name is Fox. I work for someone who wishes to speak with you.
Fox isn't a Russian name.
It's the name I'm prepared to give you.
Right,
Zoya said, and then she walked around the desk, her hands still up. The three dark-haired men closed on her fast, spun her around, and pushed her face down on the desk, roughly. They frisked her with surprising skill, pulling off the two knives and throwing them onto the floor. One wrenched an arm behind her back, then reached for the other arm, but she held on to the desk's edge so that he couldn't move it. They were going to be rough with her, and that meant she was going to be rough right back. It was her defiant nature. It had gotten her into trouble in the past, and if she took the time to be honest with herself now, she would have realized it was going to lead to trouble in the present. But she held the desk firmly.
Fuck these guys.
Another man began frisking her waistband, reaching under her crotch, squeezing, and then working his way down her left leg. The .38 was on her right ankle, and she knew it would be detected within seconds. Zoya struggled against the three men.
Stop resisting,
one man said, clearly with an Israeli accent.
Calm down and I will, she screamed back. What the fuck is wrong with you?
In answer, one of the men punched her in the kidneys, and her gloved hand came loose from the desk. These boys didn't fuck around, but neither did Zakharova. The man had finished frisking her left leg, and then he rose back up and started working his way down her right. Without thinking about what she was doing, she retaliated for the kidney punch. She used her left heel to find her way between the feet of the man frisking her leg. She wasn't sure if this was the one who'd hit her, but she didn't care. With all her might, she shot her foot up behind her, between the man's legs, and she heel-kicked him in the testicles. She knew from the feel and the sound that she had scored a bullseye, and the groan she heard next, along with the sound of a body impacting with the floor, only served to confirm this. Another punch to her kidneys brought a loud grunt out of her mouth, and she felt momentarily frozen in agony. Behind her, she heard the man called Fox say,
"She's not to be harmed, damn you, she's not to be harmed!"
With both hands behind her now, she felt zip ties cinching on her wrists. Court had reached for his rifle bag and brought it closer to him, but he did not unzip it. He kept Brewer updated on what was going on across the street, but it was hard to do so. Every fiber in his being told him he had to get over there and help her.
"Are you fucking listening, Brewer? They are beating the living shit out of her."
"Sounds like she's getting her own licks in."
"Defensively only. Let me engage."
"Stand fast. Let it play, Violator. Do not engage."
"Fuck that. What if they kill her?"
"They aren't going to kill her. They are just taking her into their custody. For all we know, they are the police. Or else she could be working with them, and they just haven't ID'd her yet. She sure as hell isn't working for us. Don't worry about Anthem. Get photos of the others in the room."
But Court didn't grab his camera. He kept one hand on the binos while the other hand reached for the zipper on his rifle bag and began to slowly open it while he held the binos to his eyes. Zoya was pulled to her feet by her hair and shoulders. The two Israeli security men next to her strong-armed her around, and as soon as she faced the open, well-lit room, she saw the man she'd dropped with the kick to the junk trying to struggle back to his feet. He looked at her with eyes that told her he was not going to let her attack on his manhood go. In Russian, she said,
"Fox, tell that one to back off."
Fox said,
"It does not work for me directly, Zoya. I am trying."
He switched to English.
"Ari, let it go."
"Fuck this bitch," Ari said. "She donkey kicked me in the nuts."
He spun his rifle behind his back, balled his fists, and started moving towards her. Zoya tried to pull away from the two men holding her arms, but was not strong enough to free herself. As the man closed, Fox shouted,
"Ari, don't you?"
Zoya used the men grasping her tight as leverage, and she brought both legs into the air, then executed a mighty front kick, slamming her instep into the Israeli's already wounded balls and dropping him a second time. He fell to his knees, then went fetal on his side. Fox couldn't help but laugh at this.
"I told you, Ari, the woman before you is legendary for not putting up with anyone's shit. She's more man than you."
One of the Israelis holding her laughed, while the other just smiled while he punched her in the side of the head, in an attempt to get her to stop her resistance. Court bit the inside of his cheek, then spoke softly.
Suzanne, she's not going down without a fight. It's about to get serious over there. I can stop this if you just...
Violator, listen to me. Don't do something you will regret.
I've been doing something I regret since the day I started taking orders from you.
Sit right there and report. That is an order. If you...
Court closed his eyes and tapped his earpiece, disconnecting the call. He lowered the binos, then yanked the short-barreled rifle with the laser aiming device out of the bag. Being a team player had been fun while it lasted, but it was time to go off mission. Chapter 30 Ari pulled himself to his feet for the second time, using a fallen chair in front of the desk for balance. Upon standing, he shouted back to Fox,
"More man than me? Let's see what she's really got on the inside!"
He drew a black-bladed knife from his belt, then rushed the two steps forward towards the woman, again being held by his two colleagues. As Fox shouted,
"No!"
Ari thrust the weapon at Zoya's abdomen. But the blade never connected with its target. The Israeli security man was shot through the right side of his head, his medulla oblongata destroyed by a subsonic Winchester 300 blackout round, and this instantly ceased transfer of motor and sensory neurons to his body. He tumbled to his left and dropped like a sack of bricks, as blood splattered all the way to the paneled wall 15 feet away. The two Israelis flanking Zoya let go of her and spun to the now broken window. As they raised their weapons, they immediately fell backwards in the room. One after the other, both shot through the head. Zoya launched herself backwards over the desk, difficult to do with her hands zip-tied behind her back, but she kicked her feet over her head and did a reverse somersault and fell down onto the floor awkwardly, out of sight of the window and the two men still alive in the room with her. She heard Fox and the big man running through the room towards the door, then taking off up the hall for the stairs. She crawled around to the far side of the desk, away from the window and the sniper, and grabbed one of her knives lying there where it had been tossed by her attackers. Using it, she cut her zip ties from behind. The dead Israeli named Ari was on the floor just feet away, but his rifle was to his right, and in view of the window where the shots came from. So she didn't dare go for it. Instead, she tucked back down behind the desk to think. Zoya found herself so utterly confused right now. A sniper had killed the men holding her, of this she was certain, but what was completely unclear was why. Zoya knew she didn't have a single friend or even an ally on planet Earth at the moment. Why had someone helped her? Just then, a laser pointer marked a spot in red on the paneling to her right. Zoya ducked down quickly, thinking gunfire would surely follow. There was no shooting. The light shook back and forth, as if to get her attention, and flicked on and off several times. It then very slowly began panning to the left along the wall. Zoya cocked her head in puzzlement. This mysterious sniper just kept getting weirder. The light continued panning, past the blood-splattered wall, until it finally stopped on a painting halfway across the room. It then traced up the side of the frame, stopped, and began blinking on and off again, then drawing a circle around a small area. And then it hit her. Somehow, Zoya knew this was where the safe was hidden, and the sniper wanted her to find it. Who? Why? She stood slowly from behind the desk, facing the window, looking at the ornate Edwardian-style office building across the street. After a moment, she caught a quick flash of red as the laser panned back over to the wall near her. She couldn't see the origin of the beam, but could tell it was just slightly higher than her position, perhaps on the roof. The red dot moved back to the painting and remained there. Zoya walked over to her Walther on the floor, reholstered it, then moved across the office, her eyes still on the window, her mind still not completely certain that the shooter wasn't going to target her as well. But when she arrived at the painting, the laser moved away again, far to the left, and remained in position there, totally stationary near the door to the office. She realized the sniper had propped his weapon on something and was leaving his laser designator on to show her he was not pointing the gun her way. This went a long way towards giving her the comfort to turn her back to the window, and when she did, she felt around behind the picture frame and found the latch. She swung the painting back on its hinges, revealing the safe. She looked back over her shoulder, out the window. Court watched from his dark hide under the painter's tarp, only 50 yards away. His gun was stabilized on his backpack so he didn't even have to touch it, and he held the 10-power binos to his eyes so he could watch Zoya more closely. The lights were on in the office, so he left the night vision function off. She turned around and looked back over her shoulder at the window. Through the magnification, Court felt like he was right in front of her face. He saw the sweat on her brow, her dark eyes peering hard into the night, and then he saw her soft lips as her mouth moved. "Thank you," she seemed to say, and then she turned back to the safe, pulling out a set of earphones from her hip bag as she did so. Court's heart was already banging against his ribcage. First seeing her, then engaging the men the instant before they killed her, and now her show of gratitude about what he'd just done. It was almost more than his cardiovascular system could handle. As he processed his emotions, he felt his earpiece vibrate. He watched Zoya's back as she worked on the combination, and he tapped the device. "Go for Violator."
"Sit rep."
There was unmistakable rage in Brewer's voice. "Zoya's safe. Three attackers are down and dead. Two more escaped."
"What the hell happened?"
Court sat up now, turned off the laser on the rifle next to him, hefted it, and folded it up. As he slid it back into his case, he said, "Would you believe spontaneous combustion?" His handler was furious, as Court had expected.
"You engaged the men trying to detain a rogue asset? She was a loose end, not one of us. Whose side are you on?"
"That's yet to be determined. I'm a good company man, but I couldn't watch them kill her." It was quiet for a moment. And then Brewer said,
"Of course not. I understand, Cortland. I'm sorry."
Court knew she was only being conciliatory as some sort of a manipulation tactic. She never called him by his real name, and her faux empathy wasn't very well pulled off, because virtually nobody had called him Cortland since his mom died. Brewer switched back to business mode, just as Court expected.
"Now, can you get over there and into that safe?"
"I don't have to get into that safe. Zoya is working on it right now, and it looks like she knows what she's doing." Brewer's softening tone disappeared in an instant.
"How the hell does that help us? She's not working for Langley."
"I'm going to ask her for it when she gets out of there."
"You planning on getting a room at the Hyatt to get reacquainted first?"
Court just sighed. "Violator out." He tapped his earpiece and put it in his pocket. Whatever happened for the rest of the night, he sure as shit didn't want it happening with Suzanne Brewer yapping into his ear. Zoya Zakharova took 4 minutes to get through the steel door, but once she did, she found herself in what looked like a medium-sized bank vault. It was 10 feet wide and 14 feet deep, with shelves and drawers all up and down the walls, and a table in the middle of the room. On the table, she saw money bound and stacked like it was newspaper, euros and dollars mostly. Jewelry in glass containers, a row of watches that looked like they each must have cost more than what Zoya made in a year back when she had steady work. She saw file cabinets and contracts stacked one upon the other in the unlocked drawers, bearer bonds, and satchels full of travel documents and passports. It was a motherload of supplies and loot for either an intelligence organization or an organized crime firm of some sort. Zoya could not determine which. Looking around, unsure what to make of it all, she began scanning the locking mechanisms used on a single horizontal panel built into the wall. Most of the cabinets were unlocked or didn't even have doors on them. Obviously, Cassidy considered the vault door itself the only necessary deterrent for all this loot and compromising material. But the panel on the far wall, Zoya assumed it covered a pull-out drawer, had been secured with a heavy keylock, and this she found interesting. It seemed whatever was inside, Cassidy wanted to keep it even more secure than the rest of the items in the vault. She stepped up to the panel immediately and took the lockpicking tools she'd procured from Gorik Shulga's SVR equipment cache. She began working and opened the large metal drawer in under a minute. Inside, she found one item only. It was an iPad, the newest model, along with a charger. Perplexed, she put the device inside her shirt and the charger in her hip bag, and then she headed back out of the vault, grabbing a thick-wrapped stack of 20-pound notes on the way. 5 minutes later, she had descended the outside of the building and was just dropping down to street level when a pair of black four-doors skidded through the intersection, turning her way. She tried to dive into a darkened area, but this was Earl's Court, and the street lighting was good. She turned and ran as fast as she could, unsure who was after her, but under the assumption that Fox and his big goon had called for support, and she just happened to be unlucky enough to time her escape to coincide perfectly with the arrival of the reinforcements. She was on foot. She hadn't brought a car or a motorcycle, but she was able to duck down a side street, then turn into a narrow alleyway, at the end of which she saw a sizable wall. She sprinted towards it. One of the sedans turned into the alleyway behind her. As she approached the 14-foot-high wall ahead, her brain worked through the geometry and physics involved with climbing it. She told herself the corners would be key. She could pick a side, launch up, and use a foot against the building next to the wall, then the wall itself, and alternate back and forth, harnessing the momentum generated in her run along with the momentum generated by her legs during the push-off of the climb. This basically meant she would be running up the corner, and she knew she couldn't do it for long before the momentum stored and generated equaled less than the force of gravity pulling her back to Earth, and at that point, she would fall. She hoped by then she'd be close enough to the top to grab hold. The sedan behind her had her pinned in. It stopped, and she heard car doors open. The driver put his high beams right on her. Zoya leapt into the air, right foot on the building, shoving up and high, left foot on the wall, hands slapping both surfaces for balance and a tiny bit more help with her climb. Back and forth, three steps on each side in all, and then she extended her arms over her head, grabbed the 6-inch ledge at the top of the wall, and heaved herself up with her strong arms, shoulders, and back. She had just started to fling herself over onto the other side and away from her attackers when she saw the second sedan parked there, the men from it just now getting out of their vehicle.
Dermo.
She launched to her feet and began moving across the narrow ledge no wider than a balance beam. Guns were raised in her position on both sides, but as she ran, she heard no gunfire, only Fox's voice speaking Russian.
Zoya, your father would like a word.
Instantly, she stopped. She turned towards the side of the alley from where Fox's echoing voice addressed her. She gasped out a reply.
What? What did you say? Your father. He sends his love. He asked me to bring you to him. I apologize about the men back there. They had been asked not to harm you. But frankly, you sent one of them over the edge. Your father will be furious with them and me when he finds out what happened.
He's here? In London?
Indeed.
Her heart pounded, both from the effect of adrenaline still and from the man's words.
You're lying,
she finally forced herself to say. Zoya stood in the gun sights of at least 6 weapons, still and stationary, her arms by her sides and her chest heaving from exertion from the run and the climb and the crazy stress of all this. Fox added,
Who is your friend, the sniper?
Zoya recovered from the news she just heard.
He's watching us right now. I give a signal, and...
Fox laughed.
We are 2 blocks away, down in an alley. We saw no force of men around the building, so you likely just had one comrade with you in this, and he has lost his line of sight.
She did not reply to this.
Come, let's go see the general. You'll have a nice chat.
She didn't trust Fox. But she didn't see many other options.
All right, she said. I'm coming down. Toss your weapon.
She still had the .38 in the ankle holster. It was hidden under her black pants, and the Israelis hadn't found it during their rough shakedown. So she pulled the Walther and dropped it onto the cobblestones below her.
Very well, said Fox.
I'd ask if you needed help climbing down, but from what I just witnessed, you should have no problems.
Zoya sat down on the top of the wall, spun around and hung from it, then dropped the rest of the way. She'd just begun to turn around when the sound of a car's engine and squealing tires entered the alleyway behind Fox and his car. The headlights of a green Volvo spun into view, and the vehicle raced forward at speed, clearly having every intention of slamming into the four-door parked there. All the men standing next to the car, Fox included, spun their weapons towards the threat. Zoya turned to her left and saw a window into a darkened room just 15 feet from her, and she ran for it. Racing towards the window, she knew if it was anything more than a single pane plate, she'd probably not be able to just dive through it as though she were in an old Western film. Ideally, she'd put a bullet hole or two in the glass to weaken it, then crash through, but she didn't want to stop to draw from her ankle holster. She kept running, praying she'd get lucky. But luck wasn't with her. Zoya saw, as she neared the window at a full sprint, that it was clearly double-pane energy-efficient glass. But she was committed to the leap now, so she tried to generate as much power from her legs as possible. She was sure that even if she did break the glass, she'd probably also break a collarbone in the process.
Delmo, she thought again as she went airborne.
But an instant before she made contact with the window, gunfire erupted to her right, and two rounds struck the pane in front of her, not 2 feet away, and by the bullets damaging the integral strength of the glass, she was able to dive through easily in a shower of shards, landing and sliding along the floor inside the building. Chapter 31 Court fired the shots at the window from the driver's side of his car to help Zoya get out of the kill zone, but now he bailed out into the alley with his rifle and scurried behind the vehicle. As soon as he rolled behind the car, he began taking fire. The Volvo he'd taken from the young CIA officer was instantly perforated with dozens of holes, steam spewed from the hood and glass shattered in the windows. Court was on his knees now in the alley, behind the car, trying to make himself as small as an engine block and as concealed as he could be. He was screwed out here as long as he was stuck in this location, and he needed his own way out. He dumped an entire magazine from the 300 blackout in a spray-and-pray fashion over the hood of the car, shot through and above the roof, then dropped the rifle and pulled his Glock 19. He spun and fired into a darkened window on his right, the same building Zoya had just escaped into. He reached over the Volvo again, this time with the handgun, and fired a dozen or so rounds, hoping to get these assholes to look for some temporary cover. He rose to his feet and ran for the broken window pane, diving through it, chased along by gunfire. He landed hard and awkwardly on a school desk, flipping it and himself over several times before coming to a stop. He rose in the darkened room and fired back through the two windows into the alley, emptying his weapon into a man who appeared there with a submachine gun. Court reloaded his last mag and fired another 8 rounds through all the windows in the room, back towards the alleyway, trying to buy himself some time. With only a half magazine in his hot pistol, he spun around and began running. Looking at the layout and the size of the desks in the classroom, Court could tell he was running through a primary school. He bounded out into the hall, his gun ahead of him. He had no idea if the men from the alley would pursue him in here, but he wanted to get as much space as possible between himself and them as quickly as possible. He slowed to listen for the sounds of other footfalls, hoping to track Zoya, but his ears were shot for the time being, and he heard nothing. He started running again, searching for some sort of an exit on the far side of the building. Within moments, however, he heard the shouted voices of men behind him. The surviving goons from the alley were clearly pouring through the windows. He had a few seconds on them, no more, so he decided this large and dark school might afford him a decent place to hide if he just looked for one. Turning down a narrow corridor, darker than the main halls of the school, he found a door, barely visible until he was just feet away. He turned the latch and was pleased to find it unlocked. So he entered the perfectly darkened room, shut and locked the door, and listened till the racing footsteps of at least 4 men passed by up the main hall. John Hines virtually never left his boss's side, but as Fox watched his surviving men climb through the windows in pursuit of Zoya and her unknown accomplice, he turned to his big bodyguard.
I want you in there too.
Sir, I watch over you.
Fox snapped now. If one of our guys hurts or kills Zoya, Mars will have me killed. Believe me, you preventing that will be the best protection you've ever given me.
Hines zipped up his light leather jacket to obscure his white shirt, then walked over to one of the broken windows. He stepped easily inside and began moving through a series of dark rooms and hallways. He could hear the other men running and banging their way through doors, and he could tell almost immediately they weren't clearing every room of this building. Instead, they seemed to assume the fleeing pair had just shot out an exit onto the street. But Hines himself took his time, moved with silent footfalls, and thought about what he might do if half a dozen gunmen were on his heels as he ran through this building. He stopped suddenly. What would he do? He'd find a place in this darkened warren to wait for the danger to pass. He stepped over to a stairwell, moved into complete blackness there, then leaned back against the wall. He was one man. He could not search the multi-story school alone, but he could listen for the moment Zoya and her friend decided the coast was clear, and that was when he would pounce. Hines had a pistol, but he left it in his shoulder holster. Hand-to-hand fighting was more than just his forte. It was his singular passion, so he was determined to get close enough to the male rescuer of Mars's crazy daughter to snap the man in two. His senses were acute due to some adrenaline, but he wasn't amped up about the thrill and the danger. Hines had killed many times, yet he'd never been seriously hurt in a hand-to-hand fight, and since his confidence was born out of success, he had no doubts about his prospects tonight. He'd kill the man with Zoya, and he'd scoop up that little Russian bitch and carry her back to Fox so he could take her home to Daddy. Court stood in the darkened room, waiting perfectly still for a full minute, the only sound his measured but heavy breath. But even after that minute, there wasn't enough faint light for him to get his bearings. It was clear there were no windows in the room, so he decided to turn on a light. He felt along the wall for the light switch. As he put his hand on it and started to flip it, another hand slammed down on his, pinning it to the wall. At the same time, he heard the hammer of a pistol being pulled back, just a foot from his head. Court froze. His left hand was free, but his pistol was on the right side of his body. He could go for it and draw it faster than most anyone on Earth, but not faster than it would take for that hammer behind him to slam forward and ignite a bullet in the gun that was certainly pointed at the back of his head. He remained perfectly still. The hand wore a glove, and it clasped around Court's fingers, then used them to flip on the overhead. A fluorescent bulb flickered on after a few seconds. Court continued looking towards the wall, even when the gloved hand let go, slid down his body, reached into his right waistband, and drew his pistol out of his pants. He heard soft footsteps moving backwards several feet in the room. And then, speaking English, he heard the voice that had been on his mind unceasingly for the past 4 months. "Turn around slowly, or I blow off your head." Court did so. He knew it was Zoya the instant he'd felt her hand on his, so there was no surprise on his face. Only uncertainty. A lot of uncertainty. He didn't know what she was doing, who she was working for, or why the fuck she was here. Zoya's face, in contrast, showed the astonishment she clearly felt. She was nearly 10 feet away now, a stainless steel revolver held on Court's chest, and she peered over the top of the weapon, almost uncomprehendingly. Court thought she looked exhausted to the point of being ill. Sweat beads covered her cheeks and forehead, and her hair was soaked. She wore no makeup, and there were dark circles under her eyes, clearly from protracted lack of sleep. Her chest rose and fell noticeably from the exertion of the past minutes. But she was still the most beautiful woman he'd ever laid eyes on. It occurred to Court that he'd been under the hot tarp for so long that his hair was probably pretty ridiculous looking right now. It also occurred to him that he'd never once thought about such things in the middle of an operation. Zoya looked at him for another 5 seconds, still not speaking. He broke the ice with the absolute best opening line he could think of.
"Hi."
She lowered the pistol slowly and looked at him, a little cockeyed. as if she were still trying to size him up and figure out what the hell he was doing here. Finally, she said,
"The sniper? The laser? The safe?"
Court nodded.
"Yeah, me."
And then,
"You okay?"
She slipped the weapon in her waistband, still not taking her suspicious eyes from him, and then she began moving closer. Court kept his hands away from his body, unsure if he was going to get frisked or punched, but unwilling to make any sudden moves to startle her. She moved faster as she closed, reached out with a hand, and put it behind his neck, and instantly his defenses fired. From this position, Court knew that someone, even a smaller woman, could hoist herself up and behind a larger man, get her arms around his neck, and put him into a blood choke that would turn his lights out in seconds. But instead, her hand behind his neck pulled him hard forward. She did not leap up and behind him, but she brought his face to hers and kissed him hard, pushing him up against the door. Moments earlier, he had been running for his life and dodging bullets, and now he was being kissed. After the brief shock, he was actively involved in the action now, with the woman he'd thought about thousands of times since the first day they met. They hugged silently for a moment, and then she broke free and took a step back.
"We have to get out of here," she said.
"We're okay for now. They'll run right through this building and back out onto the street. They'll be looking for us on foot."
He added,
"We need to talk."
Zoya nodded. She put her back to the wall next to him and slid down to the floor, still looking his way in disbelief. He did the same, leaning against the wall as he sat. She said,
"Brewer sent you after me?"
"No, she didn't have a clue you were here."
Zoya eyed him.
"Until?"
"Until I saw you in Cassidy's office. I told her you were here, asked her what the hell was going on."
Zoya wiped sweat from her forehead with the back of her arm, an expression of frustration on her face. Court saw that she thought he'd done the wrong thing by telling Brewer she was even here.
"And what did she tell you about me?"
"That you've been in the wind for a couple of days. That's really all I know. Some Mexicans tried to kill or capture you, but nobody knows why."
He snapped his fingers.
"Oh yeah, there's a leak at the agency, exposing Hanley's Sub Rosa ops, and you and I are totally fucked."
Zoya just shook her head and looked at the floor, taking it all in again. Court said,
"It's really great to see you, though."
She smiled at the floor, looked up to him, and leaned forward while sitting. They kissed again, hard.
"You too,"
she finally said as she pulled back. But soon she broke away, stood, put her hands on her hips, and began pacing the room.
He said, "I think you need to tell me what's going on."
Zoya stopped.
"Why? So you can tell Suzanne? If you do that, there will be a team of your cohorts from CIA here on top of me in an hour."
"And that would be bad. Why?"
"I'm here for answers. I haven't gotten them yet. I'm not going back to the States."
"Zoya, you need to realize I'm the only friend you have right now. I'll help you if I can, but you have to talk to me."
"Why were you watching Cassidy's office?"
"I was on a transport flight to the States the other night. We landed at an airport in the UK. There was a prisoner on board, unrelated to anything I was doing, a Dutch banker with intelligence about the CIA leak. A group of shooters showed up and took him. I went after them. And in doing all that, I found out that a guy named Terry Cassidy in London was a middleman for the whole op."
She nodded, kept pacing. Court leaned back against the wall.
"That's my story. Let's hear yours."
"What I'm doing doesn't have anything to do with a leak at CIA.
She made a face.
"As far as I know."
"What are you doing?"
Zoya hesitated, then said,
"Not here, not now. I'll talk to you, but let's get somewhere secure. I have a flat in Soho. It's a piece of shit, but..."
"I have a place in West Kensington, 20 minutes on foot. Less if we find a taxi. It's not too bad."
She thought it over. Court said,
"Or we could just say fuck it and get a room at the Hyatt."
It was a joke, a reference to what Brewer had said, but Zoya didn't get it.
"Bad tradecraft," she replied. "We need to go somewhere we don't need papers. Your place is good."
"Right."
In moments, they were both listening to the door, and soon afterward, they were moving through the primary school looking for an exit. They walked through the building in the darkness, their eyes wide and their ears open to detect any sort of movement around them. They neither heard nor saw anything, but they were not alone. Chapter 32. Passing a stairwell on the right, Court eyed the deeper darkness there, but detected no man-sized, man-shaped threats. He kept walking and turned his eyes forward towards the door up the hall, thinking he heard a noise on the other side. They moved forward until the door 100 feet ahead burst open, flashlights whipping around on the other side, and just then, out of the darkness of the stairwell to their right, a huge form reached out, grabbing Court by his right shoulder and yanking him sideways, spinning him to his right and pulling him closer. Court found himself inside the dark stairwell facing a massive human who loomed nearly a foot above him. Court drew his gun halfway, but a close-in glancing punch to his jaw stunned him and had him stumbling back in the stairwell, slamming into the wall to the right of the doorway. His gun clanked to the floor, but with his heel, he kicked it back through the doorway towards Zoya, who was behind him in the hallway. She had her own pistol, but the only weapon he'd seen on her was a revolver, and it couldn't have had more than 5 or 6 rounds in it. His own weapon was only half full, but he knew she'd need all the ammo she could get. Court brought his arms up to protect himself from another cracking blow, but even though he blocked it, the punch knocked him back into the wall again. More punches rained down into his arms and shoulders and onto his head. He covered defensively and rode them out, all the while expecting Zoya to help him by engaging this beast with her weapon. But instead, he heard her shout, "Contact front!" as she opened fire on the door at the end of the hall. Court sidestepped a punch from the big man, already recognizing him to be a boxer, and then ducked below a right hook. But when he rose back up again and attempted to fire out a jab of his own to the man's face, his attacker's longer reach got to him first, and Court took another blow, this time to his left eye. His head snapped back, and he was racked with pain all the way across his face. It was too dark to see much about the man beating him soundly, and he didn't have time to check what Zoya was up against. All he could do was flail ineffective punches at a boxer who was obviously both incredibly powerful and skilled. The gunfire continued behind him. It sounded like Zoya had emptied the revolver and opened up with another pistol. He assumed she'd grabbed his Glock because she kept up a steady rate of fire. He knew he only had a partial mag in the weapon, and he started to shout this out to her so that she would be aware, but a fist whizzed by in a left hook, forcing him to snap his head back and out of the way and focus fully on the next salvo of raining fists. Court knew he had to let Zoya deal with the gunman down the hall because he wasn't just in a fistfight. He was in a battle for his very life. A punch to his midsection connected when the man closed quickly on him, and this doubled Court over. He anticipated the uppercut that came next, so he shifted to his left and took the inevitable pounding fist in his right shoulder, then charged forward, wrapping his arms around the man's midsection, driving him back towards the stairs with all the power he could generate. Court had been involved in dozens of hand-to-hand fights in his life. He knew he was using enough force to bowl the man over, but just as Court drove the man to the tipping point, the powerful giant reached back with his left foot and braced it against the stairs. The big man did not fall. Instead, he pounded down on Court's head, neck, and shoulders with his elbows until Court let go. Court then caught a vicious right cross to the jaw, staggered back to the wall, and slid to the cement floor in a daze. He saw brilliant specks of light in the air all around him, but in the middle of them all, the huge man tightened and raised his big fists, then approached with a gait that told Court he was moving in for the kill.
Z, shoot this motherfucker, now!
Zoya Zakharova had been firing the Glock up the hall, hoping Court's pistol was full, because she didn't have a backup magazine for it. She'd emptied the .38 she got from Kravchenko's aircraft, and now with Court's gun, she began the slow but steady fire necessary to keep her attackers back with their heads down. She could see from the glow around their weapon lights that they were the same men who had chased her into the building from the alleyway, and there were at least 4 or 5. All she could do was lie prone to make herself a small silhouette and fire each time she saw a target to keep them from engaging her. She was certain she'd injured at least one of their number. The others were holding back on the other side of the open metal door and around the corner farther beyond it. She glanced to her right into the darkened stairwell and saw Court take a lightning-fast right cross from the colossal attacker, sending him back against the wall like a rag doll. Court slid to the ground and then called out through what sounded like a swollen mouth,
"Z, shoot this motherfucker, now!"
She'd assumed Court could handle a hand-to-hand encounter, even with a much larger man, but all she'd witnessed in the quick glances she'd had time to steal was him taking blows, not delivering them. She fired two more rounds at the door, then swung the Glock to her right towards the stairwell. She sighted on the chest of the man looming over Court and pulled the trigger. Nothing happened. She looked at the weapon in her hands and saw that the slide was locked open on an empty magazine. And she had no more ammunition. Court had fallen sideways onto his left hip. She could tell he was beaten. His arms weren't up to defend the blows that would come at any moment. He crept back on his elbows out of the doorway and into the hall. By doing this, he put himself in the line of fire from the men up the hall, but Zoya realized he was trying to get the hell away from the man currently beating him to death. Zoya began to stand. Her plan was to attack the massive form head-on, try to knock him back into the stairwell to both get herself out of the line of fire up the hall, and, by Court some time, to get up and get moving himself. But before she could do so, the doors opened at the other end of the hallway. High lumen weapon lights shone up the entire space, illuminating Zoya and the men in the doorway beyond.
"Metropolitan Police!" came the repeated shouts of at least a half dozen men. "Get down!"
Zoya heard Court groan out,
"Fucking finally!"
The big man had entered the hallway and knelt over his crawling victim, and he held his fist perfectly still now, above his head, as he turned to look at the police. After a second, he lowered his hand, turned, and disappeared into the stairwell. Zoya heard him running up the stairs. The police shouted for him to stop, but no one fired. So Zoya shot out of the hall and into the stairwell herself, but instead of taking the stairs, she found an unlocked door to the courtyard of the building, and she raced through it. Court was racked with pain, but he knew he'd have to move now, because this was his one opportunity to stay out of police custody. He saw that these cops weren't shooting, so he climbed to his feet while the men closed on him. He, too, took off into the stairwell, wincing and grunting with each movement. He found a door that led to an emergency exit to the building. Court shot through the door, setting off the alarm. He could only hope Zoya had gotten away as well. 10 minutes later, Court staggered along the sidewalk, pain in his face, his shoulders, his ribs, his abdomen, all of it encumbering his movement. It felt like he'd been tossed down a flight of stairs, only to crawl back up and get tossed down again. A white Mini Cooper pulled up beside him and stopped. He looked inside and was relieved to find Zoya behind the wheel. For myriad reasons, he was glad she was alive, was free of the police, had come back for him, and he retained the operational focus to be pleased that the person who had infiltrated Cassidy's safe, Court's objective for the evening, was back within his field of view. As quickly as he could, he moved to the passenger side. He grunted and groaned with fresh pain as he sat down, and she immediately began driving off again. After a few seconds, he coughed out,
"Nice ride."
She looked at him.
"It's stolen. Please do your best not to bleed all over the upholstery."
He put his hand on his nose and felt the blood there. It had worked its way around his mouth and onto his chin. He wiped it off, then gave her directions to his flat. As they drove, Court put his earpiece back in his ear and placed a call to Brewer. She answered it after several rings. Court said,
"Violator here. Did I wake you?"
Brewer said,
"I'm home. I have to pack for a trip."
"Odd time for a vacation."
"This is work. Heading to London soon."
"Cool. You're going to come over and be my door kicker?"
"Obviously not. I'm going for the conference."
"What conference?"
Brewer laughed.
"What conference? The annual Five Eyes Symposium in Scotland. How can you possibly not know about it?"
Court wiped a fresh drop of blood off his upper lip.
"I'm not the kind of employee who gets invited to that sort of shindig. I figure the people who do go drink champagne and pat one another on the back while they send guys like me downrange, first on shitty missions and then to fix their fuck-ups."
"You are such the martyr, Violator," Brewer said,
and Court knew she had a point. He was just bitching because he was annoyed at getting the shit kicked out of him. But he said, "How the hell are you going to catch a leak at CIA if you're over here having tea and crumpets?"
"We are working on it."
"So you keep saying."
"What about Anthem?"
Court looked to the brunette behind the wheel of the Mini Cooper. "I have her. Here with me now."
"What? Jesus, Violator. You could have led with that one. What did she find in the safe?"
Court glanced over at her. He hadn't even thought to ask. "Working on it. We've been a little busy."
"Working on it? Just reach over and grab her by the neck and shake her till it falls out."
"That's not my style, Brewer."
"Your style is to shoot them and then scrounge through their body, but I'm not lucky enough to get that out of you tonight."
When she received no reply to this, she said,
"Put her on."
Court pulled out his phone and activated the speaker function, moving the call to the phone itself and off the earpiece. He looked to Zoya and said, "It's for you." Zoya sighed a little. For a moment, Court didn't think she would even speak, but then she said,
"Hello, Suzanne."
Brewer's clipped tone stressed Court out even when she wasn't talking to him.
"Why did you break out of the safe house?"
"Because, for some reason, it didn't feel like a very safe house."
"Bullshit. I've seen the videos and I talked to William Fields. You were already free of holding when the attack started. You knew it was coming."
"I did not."
"Then why did you run?"
"I remembered some unfinished business I needed to attend to."
"Really? That's your story?"
"It's hard to explain."
Court watched as she thought for a moment. He looked for signs of deception on her face, and he thought he saw a slight twitch that made him feel what she was about to say was not the whole truth.
"In the pictures of my father's death you showed me, there was a man standing there. He lives in London. I wanted to come talk to him."
"You are saying an English solicitor was in Dagestan when your father..."
"I'm not talking about Cassidy. I'm talking about Vladimir Belyakov. You know him?"
Brewer hesitated.
"Yes. He wasn't identified in that photo by DIA. I would remember. He's now a billionaire over there in London."
"He was standing right there. I knew him back then, recognized him easily. I came over here, I talked to him, and he led me to Terry Cassidy."
"For what purpose?"
Zoya paused a long moment, then took the phone from Court's hand. She hung up the call and handed it back.
"Sorry," she said as she drove.
Court shrugged. "Don't be. I do that to her all the time."
"When we get to your place, when we have you patched up, I will tell you what I know. You can tell Brewer, I don't care. But I want you to hear this first."
Chapter 33. Lucas Renfro stood up from the table full of congressmen and aides at the Capitol Grill and shook some hands, waved to others around the restaurant, then headed towards the exit. He was alone, with no protective detail, because even though he was a CIA deputy director, he was in support and not in operations, so it was decided he didn't need the extra security. This was fine with him. If he did have a couple of Joes on his shoulder, it would have been that much harder for him to sneak off to see his mistress tonight, before returning to his home in Falls Church. He could have done it, of this he was sure. He could have ordered the men to wait out in the car while he went up to the apartment he'd rented for their clandestine liaisons, and he could have banged her for hours. His protection detail would not have said a word, because they wouldn't be there to report marital infidelity. They would be there to keep him alive. But it was a moot point, because he had no security team, just a mistress. And he had an itching need to see her tonight before going home to his wife. He'd met the congressmen and staffers during happy hour, and then they'd enjoyed a quick bite, so it was only 7:15 in the evening now. He made his way through the packed restaurant, heading for the door, and he did not notice the fit man with the beard and the blue blazer, who stood from the bar and began following him. Renfro's car was parked in the private lot just north of the restaurant, and as he walked along in the early throes of dusk, he sent a text to Trina to tell her he'd meet her at the apartment in 30 minutes, but could only stay a short while. Trina would be there. She could be relied upon to do what Renfro told her to. She'd left her husband years ago for him, and he'd not left his wife. She belonged to him now, as far as she was concerned. As he turned into the parking lot, he looked back over his left shoulder. A man walked behind him not 50 feet back, making no sound as he did so. Renfro thought nothing of it, but he knew to keep an eye out and made note of the man's clothing and general appearance. 40s, fit, with blonde hair, a blue blazer, and facial hair. Renfro continued on until he arrived at his Lexus sedan and he climbed behind the wheel. Pulling out of the garage, he saw the man who had been right behind him climbing into a black Chevy Suburban. As he drove through evening DC traffic, he called his wife and told her he was leaving drinks and heading to dinner with a couple of colleagues. She was used to his late nights with the boys, and she told him to have fun. Then he called Trina and told her he'd be at their rendezvous apartment in Woodley Park in 20 minutes. Traffic was slow, but he turned up towards Columbia Heights in a bid to get out of the heaviest congestion. He rode along, thinking about the fun he would have tonight before returning home, and he looked into his rear view again. He saw what appeared to be the same black Suburban that he'd last seen 10 minutes earlier in Capitol Hill. Or could it be a different Suburban? The SUV was right behind him now, and it pulled closer, just 20 or 30 feet back. At a stoplight, Renfro focused on the driver of the vehicle, and he saw that it was almost definitely the same man who had been behind him during the walk to the parking lot. Renfro kept looking into his rear view, not certain yet that this guy was tailing him, but his suspicions grew each and every minute as the Suburban followed his turns. He tried to remember long-ago-forgotten tradecraft about how to deal with a nearly overt tail like this, but all he could remember to do was to not panic. He wasn't panicking, but he was growing more nervous by the moment. The Suburban looked like a government vehicle, but there was no way for Renfro to know for sure. His mind filled, thinking about those who might be tailing, and slowly, a dull feeling of panic did begin welling inside him. He grabbed his phone, thinking he would call agency security, but he immediately put it down. They'd have questions for him. Why was he in this part of town, and where was he heading? For what purpose, would he think, might someone be following him? He'd need a story, and he didn't trust himself to make up something on the fly that would suffice. Quickly, he got the idea to stop at a nearby mall, do a little shopping, and see if the tail would dismount and begin a foot follow. He told himself this would accomplish two things. First, he would be able to see the number and disposition of the tail instead of just the headlights of a single vehicle behind him. This might tip him off as to whether they were government or private. And second, he'd buy something for his wife here and establish his bona fides for being in this part of town right now. He pulled into DC, USA, the largest retail space in the entire district, and he parked in the garage. It was 8 p.m. now. The mall was by no means empty, but it appeared to be a slower night, and he had no problems getting a parking space within a minute's walk of one of the entrances. As he climbed out of his Lexus and began walking through the evening, he looked around as nonchalantly as possible for the black truck. He saw no evidence of it and began to wonder if he'd imagined the entire affair. This was cutting into his already precious time with Trina, and that pissed him off. But he told himself to stick with his game plan here and go buy his wife some stupid present. He started in jewelry stores, but within 15 minutes of arriving, he stood in a Bed Bath & Beyond, looking over a set of wine glasses. She didn't really need them, but they were nice, and he decided they would suit his objective. As he turned towards the front of the store, he found himself face to face with the man in the blazer. He wore dark sunglasses, strange for indoors when the light outside was low, and he stood next to an end cap selling handheld vacuum cleaners. His hair was short and his beard was trim around his face, but waxed into a dramatic point on the end of his chin. His sideburns were striking as well. And he was clearly looking right at Renfro.
"Good evening," said the deputy director of support for the CIA.
The big man said nothing. He was a soldier, or used to be, Renfro could tell. Up close, his craggy, weather-worn appearance made him seem a little older, early 50s perhaps. But even through the suit, Renfro could tell the man was in chiseled good shape. He chilled Renfro the way he stood there so brazenly. After a few seconds, Renfro said,
"Do I know you?"
The man behind the sunglasses did not make a sound. Renfro smiled now, though he was terrified, and said,
"A little late in the day for those aviators, don't you think?"
The man made no reply. Renfro's smile drifted off as he turned away and looked around the store. A woman in her 30s stood not far from him, and he thought he caught her looking away just as he eyed her.
"She's part of the surveillance team, and there's more out there. There wouldn't just be the two of them," he told himself.
For the next 5 minutes, he wandered the Bed Bath and Beyond. He didn't take the box of stemware with him. And during his stroll, he sighted four other people who, he determined, were part of the follow. Twice he looked back at the man in the shades, and both times the man stared back his way, though each time he held some random item he'd pulled off a shelf. Renfro was certain he was being followed by a coordinated team of professionals. Other than the one overt man in the aviators, the rest seemed like extremely slick government surveillance operators. They could be either CIA or FBI. Jurisdictionally speaking, it would make more sense for it to be the latter, but he had good reasons for suspecting it might be the former. If someone in the CIA was having him tailed, he knew exactly why, and he knew he was in deep trouble. He hurried out into the mall, back to his car, and drove off, not towards Trina in his secret apartment, but instead home to his wife. It would be an hour's drive in this traffic, and he knew his mind would race during each and every minute of it. Zach Hightower smiled as he walked calmly back to his truck. His job was done for the day. He'd head home and get some rest so he could start back tomorrow morning refreshed and ready to go. His smile wasn't due to the sleep that was soon to come. It was instead for the success he'd had this evening, on his first full day of the tale. From DDS Lucas Renfro's actions tonight, Zach knew in his bones this dude had a good reason to fear a government tail, and it had been so much more fun to lean on someone with fear already built into his life than the two others earlier in the day, who seemed to have nothing to hide. And it had been clear to Hightower that Renfro was worried about everyone around him, the MILF looking at pie pans, the egg-headed doofus who sat in the massage chair, the well-dressed gay couple who argued playfully over the purchase of an espresso machine. Renfro thought they were all watching him because Renfro was wired tight, scared shitless, and guilty as hell. Zach was sure of it, and he couldn't wait to get back on the man tomorrow and turn up the heat. Fyodor Zakharov, a.k.a. David Mars, didn't sleep much at the most relaxed of times, but in the past few weeks, as the D-Day of his plot loomed, he spent more and more of his overnight hours researching, checking contacts, and poring over satellite images and Five Eyes personnel files and every other thing he could think of to better arm himself for both offensive and defensive measures. Defensively, he knew his operation had been kept tight, but some force out of his control had intervened, and now he could take nothing for granted. Offensively, he knew from his career there was always some new piece of intelligence to learn that could help him with his mission, in this case, the efficacy of the attack. Tonight, he read through a guest list hacked from one of the hotels that would be housing spillover attendees to the conference, and he worked to match names up to Five Eyes agencies and determine the best time of day to stage the attack for maximum damage. When his encrypted line rang, he snatched it up. It was Fox with all the details of the events at Terry Cassidy's office and the school a few blocks away. Mars closed his eyes as he listened, at once furious with his men and worried about Zoya's well-being, but he responded in a measured tone.
"Unfortunate, Mr. Fox."
"Yes, sir."
"We could not anticipate the sniper who..."
Mars got another call. He switched lines without telling Fox.
"David Mars, who's calling?"
The reply was delivered in a frantic tone.
"It's me. It's Barnacle."
Mars shut his eyes.
"Mr. CIA again."
For a trained intelligence agent, this man was jumpy and reckless. He'd all but outlived his worth, although Mars had one final use for the American, so he'd have to placate him now.
How can I help you?
They're on to me. I'm being tailed.
Mars cocked his head.
You're sure of it?
I've been with the agency for decades.
You are in support. You aren't exactly George Smiley.
The comment hung in the air for a moment.
I've worked the other end. I've been to the farm. Obviously, I can tell when there's overt surveillance on me.
Overt?
Well, a lead tail who is making himself seen. I might have seen others who were low profile.
Mars said,
You'll be here in no time. You'll be fine.
You don't think CIA would tail me in London? They will. They'll pick me up, too, if they have enough evidence.
What evidence can they possibly have?
The fucking banker talked, obviously.
In response to the American's tone, Mars said,
Barnacle,
in a low and threatening voice.
Sorry, it's just that...
Mars interrupted.
The banker didn't know your identity. Whatever they have, it's not from Dirk Visser. If you are, in fact, being tailed, it's simply because you're in the small cluster of those who had advanced knowledge of all the operations that were compromised. This is nothing more than an attempt to panic you.
Well, if you're wrong, I'm fucked.
Very true, mate. So, let's just assume I'm right, because I am. Go on about your life for a couple more days, because your life is about to change for the better.
Mars hung up the phone and began dialing Fox back for more information. He wasn't worried about Barnacle. If the CIA did ferret out the proof that Mars's man in the agency was in fact the mole, Barnacle did not have much information about Mars beyond the sound of his voice. Mars had other issues that were of much more concern. First and foremost was Dr. Wan's progress on the weapon for the attack in Scotland, days away, but a close second was the fact that he learned that his beloved daughter was back from the dead, running around with guns and knives, with an unknown agenda. He worried about what she was up to, and who was pulling her strings, and this made it difficult to focus on anything else.
Chapter 34
On the way to Court's flat, Zoya pulled up in front of an all-night market next to the Baron's Court tube station. She went in and bought several small bags of supplies, including food, a bottle of cheap vodka, a six-pack of beer, three large bags of ice, and some lemons. She returned in under 5 minutes, and they drove around the corner, leaving the car near the station to throw off the police. And they continued the rest of the way on foot, with Court's arm over Zoya's shoulder and his staggering further impeding their progress. Zoya helped Court descend the iron stairs, and then she took the keys from him to open the door. The West Kensington basement flat was dark until Zoya flipped on a couple of lamps, and then she immediately went to the bathroom to dump all the ice she'd bought into the tub. She closed the stopper and turned on the cold water. She went to the kitchen, looked in the freezer, and found some ice trays, and these she threw into the tub without cracking the cubes out of them. While this was going on, Court sat in the darkened den holding a cold bottle of beer to his face. His lips were swollen, blood still drained from his nostrils, his left eye was puffed closed, and his jaw,